Jay Kearney was integrated with Dr. Baer, Schwartz said. Baer said so on that recording of his. Well, no, I said. Kearney's mouth said it, and we assume that Baer was speaking it because Baer was in the background. But we have an alternate theory. It goes like this, Van said. You integrate with Kearney and go to Bear's apartment. He's expecting Kearney. You drug Baer so he passes out, make the video, shove a knife into his temple, position the three to make it look like suicide, and then take a quick trip to Loudoun Pharma with Kearney. And are back with us in time for dessert, I said. If we had dessert, I wasn't there for that part. No, because Loudoun Pharma blew up, Van said. You just accused me of murdering Baer, Schwartz said. Yes, I said. And the six janitors, Van said. And Jay Kearney, I said. Eight total, Van said. I'm done speaking to you two, Schwartz said. I'm not going to say any more to you without a lawyer. If you plan to arrest me, do it now. Otherwise, get out of my house. Mr. Schwartz, one more word, Van said. Mr. Schwartz looked at her, impassive as only a threep can be. Interpolator, Van said. What did you say? Schwartz said. Oh, I think you heard me just fine, Van said. I don't know what the word means, Schwartz said. We're past that point, don't you think, Mr. Schwartz? Van said. You know perfectly well what that word means. And you know what it means that we know it. It means that you were fucked, sir. Magnificently so. Schwartz was silent again. Options, Van said, and ticked up a finger. Door number one. You maintain your right to remain silent and your right to an attorney. Good for you. I applaud your stand. We arrest you for those eight murders we've mentioned, plus the murders of Bruce Scow and Brenda Rees. We'll also be charging you with the kidnapping of Kearney and Scow and Rees, not to mention the attempted murders of me and Agent Shane here, plus a whole other grab bag of miscellaneous charges, which I won't go into, but I imagine that you are already running down a list of in your brain because you are a lawyer. We go to trial, you lose, your body goes into a federal Hayden detention center, and you get to speak to other human beings 1 hour a week forever. We're fine with that option, by the way, I said. Yes, we are, Van said. She ticked up another finger. Door number two. You talk. She put her hand down. Make your choice. You have 5 seconds, after which we assume you're going with door number one, which we're fine with, I said. Yes, we are, Van said. Schwartz sat down and waited until the count of four, maybe four and a half. I want a deal, he said. Of course you do, Van said. Full immunity, he began. No, I interrupted. You don't get that. You're going to prison, Schwartz, Van said. You better get used to that. What we're discussing now is where, how long, and how bad it will be. Full immunity or nothing, Schwartz said. Nothing works for us, I said. Mr. Schwartz, I don't think you fully appreciate what I meant when I said you are magnificently fucked, Van said. It means that we have more than enough to bury you forever. And we will. Forever. But the fact of the matter is, you're not the person we really want. You're not the main attraction. I'm pretty sure you know who we're talking about here. But if we can't get him, we'll be happy to take you, I said. It's true, Van said, and let's be honest, Schwartz. He'll be happy to let us take you too. You, of all people, should know how many lawyers he has and how good they are. The very second he learns we bagged you is the second all of it, gets shoved onto you. I can see the press release now. He'll be shocked and disturbed at the allegations and will pledge to cooperate fully with the authorities, which means us, I said. And you know what? Van said. At that point, we might just decide to cut our losses and go with what we have. We'll still look good, and honestly, it'll be a nice object lesson for you on the subject of blind loyalty to a man who'll be happy to throw you to the dogs. Schwartz was silent again. Then, what are you looking for from me? All of it, of course, Van said. Dates, plans, how you used Accelerant's various companies to further your goals, who else is involved, what the end game was, what both you and Hubbard were planning to get out of it all. Why you chose Sonny and Scow, I said. That's right, Van said. You have the upper echelons of the Navajo Nation ready to run you down with a car. You picked the wrong guy to mess with when you picked Sonny. It's probably just as well we'll be putting you away for a while. How long? Schwartz asked. He was entirely defeated now. How much time are we talking about here? Are you asking for a specific number of years, I asked. Schwartz turned to me. I have children, Agent Shane, he said. You're missing that soccer game, Mr. Schwartz, Van said, surprisingly gently. You'll be missing high school graduation, too. Depending on what we get from you now, we can work on having you out to walk one of them down the aisle. Chapter 24 Nicholas Bell entered Cassandra Bell's second-floor apartment and entered the living room, which was, in fact, where Cassandra Bell lived, the bedroom of the apartment being used as storage and as a lounge for her caregivers. Cassandra's morning caregivers had left for the day. Her afternoon caregivers would not come to the apartment for another hour. Nicholas walked over to the living room's major feature, a cradle, in which lay a young woman. It looked, as all Haydens did, as if she were sleeping.
It's good of you to come see me, brother, Cassandra said. I haven't seen you at all this last week.
Her voice was carried by a speaker next to her cradle, into which was also embedded a small camera, which she could use to see within the apartment. Cassandra preferred a simple, real-world presentation, which may have been why Nicholas paused when he saw the unfamiliar shape in the room, a threep.
A gift from an admirer, Cassandra said, following Nicholas's gaze. Not someone who admires me enough to know that I don't use, nor have I ever used, a personal transport. But one of my caregivers knows someone who needs one. It's waiting for her to come take it.
Nicholas nodded and smiled and took his small backpack from his shoulder. He unzipped it and reached inside.
Why, brother, Cassandra Bell said, did you bring me a gift?
Yes, Nicholas said. He took the large kitchen knife he had drawn from the backpack and thrust it into the young woman in the cradle, driving it deep into her abdomen. Two more hard, deep thrusts into the belly, pushing upward. A rough jab downward, piercing the left upper thigh. A thrust in search of the femoral artery. The flesh sliced open, pale. Three thrusts making a sloppy triangle of cuts just below the sternum. One vicious slash on the left side of the neck, and a matching slash on the right, opening up the arteries, taking blood to the brain, and the veins drawing it away. Nicholas Bell dropped the knife to the floor and stepped back, breathing heavily. He stared at the ruined body as if something about it puzzled him, such as the body he had stabbed 8 times now had not one drop of blood coming out of it.
Brother, Cassandra Bell whispered. It didn't work.
I launched myself from the chair I was sitting in and tackled Nicholas Bell, who went down rolling and squirming. He managed to get out of my grip and scrambled to his backpack. I rolled up and saw him, gun in hand, aiming at me. Oh, come on, I said. I just got this threep. The crash behind us, the sound of FBI agents breaking down the door to get at Nicholas, distracted Nicholas just enough for me to run at him, but not enough for me to break his aim. He fired, and the bullet took me in the shoulder, spinning me. Nicholas turned and fired 3 shots into the sliding glass door separating the living room and the balcony, and then ran into the shattered glass, hands up to protect his face. The glass tore away in a sheet, and then Nicholas was through and stumbling over the balcony. Fuck, I said, and followed him. That's when I learned the shot Bell took at me had affected the movement of my right arm. I tumbled over the balcony railing and fell hard onto the concrete walkway underneath. If I had been in a human body, I'm pretty sure I would have been dead or paralyzed. But I wasn't. I stood up, scanned around, and saw Bell 30 yards ahead, limping but moving surprisingly fast. His gun was still in his right hand. What the hell just happened? Van said in my head. He jumped out of the balcony, I said. He's running on 9th Street, headed toward Welburn Square. I'm going after him. Don't lose him again, Van said. Again? I said, and then went running. Bell's limp had gotten worse when I caught up to him just short of Welburn Square.
I jumped him and we both went down on the red brick sidewalk. I grabbed at him with my one good arm. He kicked it off and pistol-whipped me with the butt of his gun. This did not work as well as he wanted it to. I had turned down my pain sensitivity. He turned the gun on me, and I rolled away. Bell took off again, limping, cutting across the central circle of the grass in the square, scattering passers-by when they saw his gun. I went after him again, tripping him short of Taylor Street. He turned as he stumbled and fired at me, hitting me in the hip. My left leg collapsed under me. I looked up to see Bell give a small grin of triumph and then run out into Taylor Street, on which he was immediately struck by a car. Bell splayed dramatically across the hood of the automobile and then collapsed on the road, clutching his leg. Van got out of the driver's side, walked over to Bell, ascertained that he was not in immediate danger of death, and handcuffed him. 2 minutes later, all the other FBI agents had caught up to us. Van walked over to me, still down on the sidewalk. She sat down next to me and pulled her e-cigarette from her jacket pocket. "That's the third threep you've ruined in 2 days," she said. "Fourth," I said. "I don't want to tell you how to do your job," she said, "but I will say that if I were your insurer, I'd drop your ass." "You hit our suspect with a car," I said. "Oops," Van said. She sucked on her cigarette. "You could have killed him." "I was going 5 miles an hour," Van said. "And anyway, it was an accident." "You're not supposed to be able to get into accidents like that anymore," I said. "It's amazing what you can do when you disable auto drive," Van said. "We promised Cassandra Bell we wouldn't hurt her brother," I said. "I know," Van said. "It was a risk. On the other hand, that asshole just shot my partner. Twice. It wasn't Bell who shot me. That's not the asshole I was talking about." She put her cigarette away. "I'm curious about a number of things," Van said to Bell. They were sitting across the table from each other in one of the Bureau's interrogation rooms. Van had a manila folder in front of her. "But I'll tell you what I'm curious about right this second. It's that you're here in an FBI interrogation room, under arrest, and you have neither affirmatively invoked your right to remain silent or asked for your lawyer. You should. You should do both." "Yes," I said. I was standing behind Van. I was in one of the threeps the FBI used for visiting agents. The agent who had been using it half an hour before was currently stewing in Chicago because I had interrupted her work. She could stew for a while longer. "Although if I were you, I wouldn't try to call Sam Schwartz." "Why not?" Bell asked, looking up at me. "We arrested him this morning on charges of murder and conspiracy relating to the Loudoun Pharma bombing," I said. "Won't his boss be surprised?" "Hubbard's in the clear," Van said. "Everything points to Schwartz alone. Not the best sort of extracurriculars to have, though." She turned back to Bell. "Now, would you like to remain silent?" she asked. "When you answer, keep in mind that the minute you are out of your apartment and on your way here, we executed a warrant to search your residence and belongings, which is to say we've already found the video you made confessing to the murder and also your suicide." "Which explains the gun," I said. "Stabbing's fine for your sister, but you wanted your own end to be quick and mostly painless. But I suppose me rushing you scrambled your plans a bit." "So," Van said again, "do you want to remain silent? Do you want a lawyer?" "You have the video," Bell said to Van. He motioned up to me. "Your partner saw the attack. What would be the point?" "To be clear, you're waiving your right to silence and to an attorney," Van said. "I really need you to say yes, if that's in fact what you want." "Yes," Bell said. "It's what I want. I intended to kill my sister, Cassandra Bell. That was my goal." "Well, that makes our lives a lot easier," Van said. "Thank you." "I'm not doing it for you," Bell said. "I wanted people to know my sister is dangerous." "Is this covered in your suicide note?" Van asked. "Because if it is, if it's all the same, we can just skip ahead to us taking you in and putting you in federal detention while you await sentencing." "Well, there is that one thing," I said. Van snapped the fingers of her left hand. "That's right. I did have one more question for you, Nicholas." "What is it?" Bell asked. "How long are you going to keep this up?" Van asked. Bell looked at her uncertainly. "I don't know what you mean by that." "I mean, how long are you going to keep pretending to be Nicholas Bell, Mr. Hubbard?" Van asked. I ask only because Shane and I have a bet going on here. Shane thinks you're only going to keep this up until we get you into detention. After all, you do have a life and a multinational conglomerate to run, and now that you've confessed as Bell and admitted guilt, the hard part is done. That's right, I said. When the real Bell surfaces and backtracks in detention, no one will believe him. They'll think he's begun to regret his decision and is maybe hoping for some sort of psychiatric ruling. That's a fair call, Van said, but I said no. You've come too far with this to half-ass it now. I think you're committed to this all the way through the sentencing and housing. It's only once the door slams shut on Bell in a 6x9 cell that you'll know for sure you've gotten away with it. So, you have to stick with it, just like you've stuck with it this entire week. Yes, that means Accelerant doesn't have you at the helm, but maybe when Bell's asleep, you can sneak out and leave a note saying you're on vacation for a couple of weeks. They can get along without you. Legal might have a problem, I observed. They've got a lot of lawyers, Van said. They can work around. Neither of you are making any sense, Bell said. He's sticking with it, I said. Well, he has to right now, Van said. But let's mix things up. Mr. Bell, I have a picture for you. Van opened the manila folder, pulled a picture out of it, and slid the photo over to Nicholas Bell. Meet Camille Hammond, she said to him. 23 years old and a resident of the Lady Bird Johnson Hayden Care Facility in Occoquan, which is where the NIH stores Haydens with other severe brain disorders who have no family or other means of support. More accurately, Camille was a resident until Wednesday evening when she died of a persistent pneumonial infection, unfortunately common in people in her situation. Bell looked at the picture but said nothing. The NIH wasn't too thrilled with us when we asked if we could borrow her for today's festivities, Van continued. But then they also didn't want to see Cassandra Bell brutally murdered by her own brother on the eve of the largest civil rights march on D.C. in a decade either. So in the end, they decided to help us. She leaned in across the table to Bell. So here's the thing I want to know, she said. You came into that room to murder your sister, someone you knew your entire life. I'm a little confused how you managed not to recognize that the woman you stabbed 8 times was not the same woman that you had known for 20 years. Bell looked up and stayed silent. You know what? Don't answer that, Van said, and looked back at me. Tell them to bring in Tony. I sent the message with my inside voice. A minute later, Tony was in the room with us. Tony Wilton, Lucas Hubbard, I said, by way of introduction. Lucas Hubbard, Tony Wilton. If it was a week ago, I'd say it was an honor to meet you, Tony said to Bell. As it is, I can still say I admire your skill at coding. Tony, Van said, if you would be so kind as to catch up Mr. Hubbard on your latest adventures. So that thing you did where you downloaded code into the processor through the interpolator really was some genius-level work, Tony said. But it's also really dangerous because, well, Tony gestured at Bell, for obvious reasons. So, last night I wrote a patch that would block that pathway, and the NIH, which can still dictate mandatory patching, put it at the top of their priority queue. Right around the time you entered Cassandra Bell's apartment, it started going out to every integrator in the United States. And after their patch, it'll go into the general queue for Haydens, too. I mean, there's no way that you could exploit it with a Hayden like you do with an integrator. But then we didn't see this coming with the integrators until you exploited it. Evil but brilliant. So we decided better safe than sorry. I'm not understanding anything you're telling me, Bell said. What is an interpolator? Tony looked over to me. He's really committed to this, he said. What choice does he have, I said. If he drops out now, the real Nicholas Bell surfaces and spills everything. Which reminds me, Tony said, and turned back to Bell. I'm sure you, of all people, are aware that patches to neural networks can be general, or they can be tailored to be very, very specific, as in a patch for one single neural network. Bell looked back at him blankly. Okay, since you're pretending not to understand any of this, I'll make it really simple, Tony said. In addition to coding a very general patch last night, I also coded a very specific patch for the neural network here. Tony tapped the top of Bell's head lightly. It does two things. One of them deals with control of the data stream. Pay attention, Van said to Bell. This is good. Usually, during integration, either the integrator or the client is able to stop the data flow, if the client is done with the session or the integrator's had enough of the client, Tony said. Right now, you've managed to disable Bell's ability to kick you out of his head. That doesn't seem fair, Van said. Right, Tony said. So the patch I just had automatically downloaded into Bell's network removes your ability to cut the data stream. You've got Bell trapped in his own head. And now I've got you trapped in the same place. Go ahead, try to cut it. Oh, he's not going to do that, Van said. You're bluffing to try to get him to leave Bell's head. Huh, Tony said. I hadn't thought about that. Fair call. He'll find out soon enough, I said. He had Nicholas Bell trying to kill his sister. I tapped my head. I have it right here. When the door of that 6x9 cell slammed shut, he'll be in there with Bell. So that's the first thing about the patch, Tony said. The second thing is something I think you're going to really like. Hold that thought, Van said. Tony silenced himself. Van turned to Bell. Anything to say yet, Mr. Hubbard? I honestly don't know what you are going on about, Bell said pleadingly. I'm very confused. Let's aim for some clarity, Van said, and nodded to me. Our next guests, please. Another minute, and May and Janice Sani came into the room. Van got up to give May her seat. Janice stood behind her grandmother, hand lightly on her shoulder. This is him? May asked, looking at Van. It is, Van said. On the inside, at least. I don't know these two ladies, Bell said. And that's the first true thing you've said all afternoon, Van said. Lucas Hubbard? May and Janice Sani, I said. Their last name may sound familiar, because you used Johnny Sani, their grandson and brother. This is insane, Bell said. I think we've done enough of the preliminaries, Van said. And I'm getting tired of the bullshit, so let's get right to it. She put her foot on Bell's chair and spun it back and out from the table. We lied to you about Schwartz, she said to Bell. We've got him on murder and conspiracy, but he's cut a deal with us. He's told us the whole story of your play to dominate the Hayden market. His version of the story doesn't look good for you at all. We're ready to hit accelerant with a battalion of forensics geeks. I've got 20 more at your house waiting for me to tell them to go in. We have almost more warrants on you and your companies than we have people to serve them. Almost. Van kicked Bell's chair lightly. It jumped a fraction of an inch and Bell with it. But you are still here playing your idiotic game of I'm not Hubbard. It's time to stop playing that game, Van said. So, here's what we're doing now. You stop pretending to be Bell. She pointed to May and Janice Sani. You can start by telling the two of them what really happened to Johnny Sani. They deserve to know. Or, you can keep pretending to be Bell. In which case, here's Tony to tell you what happens next. She looked over to Tony. Tell them about the other thing your patch does, she said. It flips the script, Tony said. A little more technical, please, Van said, looking at Bell. I think he can keep up. When a client uses an integrator, the integrator steps back and lets the client's consciousness drive the body, Tony said. The integrator assists, but is supposed to hold back. He gestured at Bell. With your variation of it, the integrator's consciousness is pushed back entirely. It's disconnected from any control of the body at all. The patch I've introduced into Bell's body reverses that. It gives the integrator complete physical control while relegating the client to the background, unable to do anything but watch. The client experiences lock-in, I said. That's right, Tony said. Now, obviously, it makes no sense to do this in the usual client-integrator relationship. But then, he looked down at Bell, this isn't the usual relationship, is it? Bell gets his life back, and Hubbard is trapped inside forever, I said. And that's not even the good part, Van said. She got in very close to Bell. Here's the really good part. Bell is a known integrator for Hubbard now. So why not just let that roll?
Have him say he's Hubbard? I asked.
Have him be Hubbard, Van said.
She looked up at me and Tony. We back off on the warrants, let Schwartz take the fall, and install Bell at the head of Accelerant. And then he starts dismantling the company, sells it off piece by piece. And with the profits from the sales, he invests in Hayden's, starting with your dad's new thing, Chris.
Oh, right, I said. I leaned in on the table toward Bell. My father just reached a deal with the Navajo Nation to fund a non-profit competitor to the Agora, I said.
The Navajo have an immense server farm, more than enough room for the entire Hayden Nation, staffed by Navajo techs, affordable and accessible, and technically not in U.S. territory. We're announcing it tomorrow at the march, to make the point that the Hayden community has another option besides being strip-mined by someone trying to corner the market.
Just think, Van said.
Cassandra Bell announcing it, Marcus Shane standing on one side, Lucas Hubbard on the other, coming together for every Hayden, and then Hubbard dismantling his company one piece at a time to keep funding the goal until there's nothing left. It's a dream, I said, standing back from the table. Yes, Van said. A more than slightly unethical dream.
More unethical than bombing competitors, attacking federal agents, and planning to assassinate a Hayden activist? Van asked.
Well, no, I admitted.
Then I'm fine with it, Van said. And the only people who will ever know are in this room right now.
Anyone have a problem with it?
No one said anything.
Then these are the options you have, Hubbard, Van said, returning to Bell. Admit who you are, and tell May and Janice what happened to Johnny Sonny. You're guilty, but your company will survive. Keep doing what you're doing, and we flip the script. Bell gets his life back from you, and then takes over your life. And you watch everything you've ever done fall apart. Make your choice. Bell sat there, silent, for more than a minute. Then,
at first it was more a thought experiment than anything else, Hubbard said.
And it was definitely Hubbard. Even cuffed to a chair, the swagger was there.
I had written the code and modeled the network, designed for a client to integrate full-time. There was no point to it other than curiosity. But then Abrams Kettering came along and the business model I'd been working on was changing. Other businesses started to panic, but I knew there were opportunities there. They just needed to be directed in a way that was effective but untraceable and not reproducible. If I used the network I designed, I knew I could manipulate people and events in ways that other businesses couldn't, and in a way that couldn't be traced back to me. It was Sam who pointed out that Medicord had access to Navajo Nation medical records, and that those records weren't part of the U.S. National Health Database. We could find a test subject there who would be otherwise invisible. No records elsewhere, nothing to track. We found two, Johnny and Bruce. We moved on Johnny first. He was...
Hubbard stopped, realizing how what he was about to say would sound to Johnny Sonny's family.
Say it, Van said.
He was mentally deficient, Hubbard said. Easy to fool, easy to control. We set him up in California through a Chinese company Accelerant had a minority stake in. Our contacts with him were through one-of-a-kind threeps. Everything untraceable, even though Johnny wasn't smart enough to figure it out. Overcautious, we kept everything small as possible. Only Sam and I knew everything. When the network was installed, we tested it first for a few minutes at a time, then an hour or two. We became comfortable using Johnny for more things, driving him on simple tasks. A little corporate spying, some bits of sabotage. Nothing really significant, simply testing the capabilities. We figured out that Johnny was limited. Not in his brain, that didn't matter when I was driving him. But the same lack of identity that attracted us to him limited him. Having no identity makes it harder to move in our society, not easier. With what we learned from Johnny, we started working on commercial network models. We own Luckturn,
and we had the database of networks to work with. I came up with the interpolator method to hack into the networks and leave a door open. All we had to do was wait for the right opportunity. And then Abrams Kettering passed, and the walkout in March were planned. It was the right opportunity to destabilize the market and pick off companies we wanted. I knew Nicholas Bell was an integrator. I'd known people who used him. And I knew that when Abrams Kettering passed, he would be looking for a long-term contract. But I didn't want to approach him directly. I had one last job for Johnny Sani. I drove him out to D.C. and used him to contact Bell, posing as a tourist. I used him to get into Bell's mind. When I was in Bell, Sam was supposed to link right in and take over Johnny. But Sam got distracted for a couple of minutes. Johnny came to, looked around, grabbed the love seat, and ran at the window with it, and pushed it out into the street. Then he came back, grabbed the glass, and smashed it against the dresser. I thought he was going to use it on me. I put up my hands. He yelled at me, telling me that now someone would come up to see what was happening. He wanted to stop being used. He wanted to know what he was being used for. He said he wanted to go home. Hubbard paused again. Keep going, Van said. If you won't say it, Bell will. It's all coming out, Hubbard. I laughed at him, Hubbard said. I knew Sam was coming to link to him, and then that would be the end of it. So I told him that what he was being used for was to make me very rich. He wanted to know if he'd ever been made to hurt people. I told him that he didn't remember it anyway, so he shouldn't worry about it. Then he said to me, I know you're a bad man, and I know you won't let me go home, so now I'm going to make trouble for you. And then he cut his throat. May and Janice stared at Hubbard stonily. I remembered Claw Redhouse telling me how they tried not to show too much grief. I'm sorry, Hubbard said, looking at May and Janice. Don't you dare, Janice spat. You're not sorry Johnny is dead. You were going to kill someone today. You're sorry you got caught, but you did get caught. You got caught because Johnny stopped you from getting away with what you were doing. He made trouble for you, just like he said. My brother was slow, but he could figure things out if he took enough time. He figured you out. And now look at you. My brother is 10 of you. Janice helped May up out of the chair. The two of them left the room without looking back. You saw him cut his throat, but then you panicked, didn't you? Van said after they left. You actually left Bell's body for at least a couple of minutes. Yes, Hubbard said. I left. But Sam told me to go back in. He said if Bell told anyone about his experience, that they would figure out what we had done, and sooner or later it would come back to us. I had to stay with Bell until the thing was done. He snorted. He said he'd come up with a cover story that would last through Saturday, and that would be long enough, for all the good it did either of us. You were gone just long enough for Bell to give us a clue, Van said. He was confused just enough by what was happening to let us know something was seriously wrong. Thanks for that. Hubbard smirked ruefully and looked up at Van. Now what? He said. Now it's time for you to go get arrested for real, Mr. Hubbard, Van said. Go back to your body. Do it now. You need to swap out the patch, Hubbard said. About that, Tony said. What about it? Hubbard asked. We lied to you, Van said. There was no patch. There was a general patch that closed the interpolator back door, Tony said. That was true. So if you backed out, you wouldn't have been able to come back in.
But we knew you wouldn't do that, Van said. So we decided to press our luck.
There was no script flipper either, Hubbard said. If we had that, we would have led with that, I said. And then we would have made you watch your company burn. Now go, Hubbard, Van said. My colleagues are waiting for you. You've got a lot to answer for. Hubbard left, which was not noticeable. Nicholas Bell surfacing was. He shook himself, almost knocking over his chair, and sucked in his breath.
Jesus, he said.
Nicholas Bell, Van said.
Yes, Bell said. Yes, it's me.
Nice to meet you, Van said.
Hold still, I said, gently putting a hand on his shoulder.
I need to get you out of these cuffs, I undid him. He shook out his arms and rubbed his wrists.
Mr. Bell, Van said. Yes, he said.
What Hubbard said about Johnny Sonny, Van asked. Bell nodded.
It was true, he said. I'm sorry you had to watch that, Van said.
Bell laughed shakily.
It's been a long week, he said.
Yes, Van said, that it has. I hate to say this, I said to Bell, but we need to have you answer some questions. We need you to tell us everything you saw or heard while Hubbard had control of your body.
Trust me.
I intend to tell you everything I know about that son of a bitch, Bell said. But there's something I would really like to do before I do that. If I can, if you don't mind.
Of course, Van said. Tell us what you would like to do.
I'd really like to see my sister now, Bell said. Chapter 25. Van pointed at the stage in front of the Lincoln Memorial, where the speakers for the Hayden March stood. Your father looks pretty good up there, she said, nodding toward Dad, standing next to President Vicente and Cassandra Bell, held in a portable cradle. He looks like an ant, I said, which, for my father, is pretty impressive.
We could get closer to the stage if you want, she said. The rumor is you know a guy.
I do, I said, but I think we're fine where we are. Van and I stood at the periphery of the crowd, far down the mall from the stage and the speeches.
No riots, Van said. I wouldn't have put money on that yesterday morning.
I think the Hubbard thing took the air out of those sails, I said. News of Hubbard's and Schwartz's arrest was significant enough to escape the news dead zone of a Saturday late afternoon. We made sure that everyone had as much information as they wanted on the details. Saturday night in D.C. was no more filled with incident than most Saturday nights. Sunday was Sunday.
We dodged a bullet, Van said, agreeing.
In a general sense. You took several.
Yes, I said. If I have learned anything this week, it's to invest in economy threeps. I can't afford this sort of attrition.
Yes, you can, Van said. Well, yeah, I said. I can, but I don't want to. We walked the mall, her in her sling, and me in a borrowed threep. She glanced back toward the stage.
You could have been up there, she said, standing there with your father. You're still famous enough that you could have given his deal with the Navajo even more credibility.
No, I said. Dad's got credibility to burn, even after this week. And I don't want that life anymore. There's a reason I'm an FBI agent, Van. I want to be useful for something else other than as a poster child.
The Haydens could still use a poster child, Van said.
Abrams Kettering still takes effect at midnight. Things are going to get harder from here. A lot harder.
Someone else can do that job, I said. I think I'm better at doing this job.
You are, Van said. At least, this week you were.
They're not all like this, right? I said. The weeks, I mean.
Would it be so bad if they were? Van asked.
Yes, I said. Yes, it would.
I did say I was going to ask a lot of you, Van said, on that first day. You remember?
I remember, I said.
I'm not going to lie to you. I kind of just thought you were trying to scare me.
Van smiled and patted my shoulder. Relax, Shane, she said. It gets better from here.
I hope so, I said.
Excuse me, someone said. We looked over and there was a threep standing with a few other people. It pointed to Van.
You're that FBI agent, the one that arrested Lucas Hubbard.
Yes, Van said, one of them.
How cool, the threep said, and then motioned at the group.
Would you mind if we got a picture?
No, Van said.
Be happy to. Awesome, the threep said. Then it and the group began to crowd around Van. One of them handed me a camera. Would you mind? She asked. Not at all, I said. Everybody crowd in. They crowded in. You're loving this, aren't you? Van said. Just a little, I said. Now, everyone say cheese.
And now, a bonus novella. Unlocked, an oral history of Hayden syndrome. Introduction.
25 years ago, doctors and hospitals were receiving their first cases of the disease that was initially misdiagnosed as a variant of the influenza A virus subtype H5N1, and then briefly known as the Super Bowl flu and the Great Flu. And then finally, after the full extent of the damage it could cause was known, named Hayden syndrome. The disease would claim millions of lives and sentence millions more to lock in, a paralysis of the body that leaves the mind fully functional. Between that first appearance and today, our nation and the world has experienced the tragedy of the onset of the disease, the triumph of the technological and social response to its challenges, and the aftermath of both, positive and negative, on our culture and the world we live in. This document is the result of interviews with many of the doctors, scientists, politicians, and ordinary people who were instrumental in both our understanding of Hayden syndrome and our national and global response to it. While no single document can comprehensively chronicle the effects and changes to our world that Hayden syndrome created, the goal with this document is to give those who were born after its onset, some of them now fully adults, a screenshot of how the generation before them responded to what is now considered the single greatest public health challenge the planet has experienced. It's also to remind them that while Hayden syndrome is no longer transmitting in such vast numbers, it is still one of the planet's major ongoing health issues, with tens of thousands of new cases annually in the United States alone. Only vigilance and a respect for the disease stands between us and another epidemic. As our nation prepares to implement the former Abrams-Kettering bill, now the Progress with Prosperity law, and allows private entrepreneurship to continue the work on Hayden syndrome originally funded in the public sphere, let us remember there should always be a place for the sort of basic research and prevention that can only be done by a well-funded and citizen-focused governmental organization such as the Centers for Disease Control. The CDC is happy to have funded this oral history. Yvette Henry, M.D., Director, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Part 1, Outbreak.
Benjamin Maldonado, former chief investigator, Hayden syndrome, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
The first thing we have to do is admit we blew it. We misidentified Hayden's at the outset. And when we did that, we gave it an extra couple of weeks to spread. And that's what killed us.
Natasha Lawrence, investigator, Hayden syndrome, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
When Hayden's was first moving around in the world, we were also tracking a new and aggressive variant of H5N1 influenza, bird flu. The bird flu had come out of South China, where it probably got its start in one of the poultry factories there. It had already killed a couple dozen people in South China, and we were seeing it pop up elsewhere, including London and New York, which were the first major population centers we saw Hayden's in. Hayden's first blush symptoms were very much like the bird flu, and a number of the people who contracted Hayden's also had the H5N1 virus in them as well. You apply Occam's razor to the problem of a person having flu-like symptoms who also has the bird flu virus in their bloodstream, and it's going to tell you that the first is the cause of the seconds. And in 99.9% of the cases, that would be exactly right. In this case, it was exactly wrong.
Irving Bennett, professor of journalism, Columbia University.
I was a science reporter at the New York Times when Hayden's hit. I and every other science writer at the time was told it was bird flu and were asked to remind people that this was one of those years where the government had actually gotten ahead of the virus and had adequate stocks of vaccine out there, so people should go out and get their shots. Which was fine, until I started hearing from doctors that the ERs were beginning to fill up with people who had the flu who also had gotten their shots. My first assumption was that there was something wrong with the vaccine, that either it was ineffective because of poor manufacture or graft, or that it was the vaccine itself that was giving people the flu. Either would have been a great story. I tracked some of the vaccine that looked like it was failed back to the manufacturer, Synvaxis in Maryland, who agreed to test the remainder of the lot. Those tests came back negative, which is to say, the vaccine was perfectly effective. By this time, other vaccine makers were also testing their lots and finding nothing wrong there either. This is when we knew for sure something else was going on. And then Super Bowl Sunday happened.
Monique Davis, M.D.
I was working the ER at Lutheran Medical Center on Super Bowl Sunday. I traded for that day because I don't actually care about football, and I could bank some favors by taking the day. I figured it would be reasonably light because the Jets were in the Super Bowl, which meant that lots of the people who would otherwise be doing the stupid things that get you sent to the emergency room would be at home in front of the TV instead. I was partly right. The day was light on gunshots and broken bones and violent trauma, but when I started my shift, the ER was already full of flu victims, mostly older people or people who didn't care they might miss the game. When I talked to them, a lot of them said they already had their flu shot for the year. When I sent in the blood work, I told the lab to be looking for something other than the bird flu we knew was going around. By the time the game started, the ER was packed. I texted a friend of mine over at Maimonides, and he said he was getting the same thing in their ER. All over the city, ERs were piling up with flu victims. Some of them were saying they tried waiting until after the game was done before they headed over, but they just couldn't wait anymore. This suggested to me that when the game was done, we were going to get slammed. I told the chief resident that if I were him, I would get some more staff into the ER as soon as possible. We didn't even have until the end of the game. The Jets were down 35 points by halftime, and by the third quarter, there was hardly any room to move in the ER.
Benjamin Maldonado.
New York got the worst of it on Super Bowl Sunday, but we saw a sharp rise in flu-related ER visits in nearly every major U.S. city that day. That told us that whatever we were looking at probably got into the U.S. through New York and then dispersed through air travel, which meant that it was easily communicable but possibly not immediately evident. People who are ill enough to need an ER aren't going to get on a plane. It was something that probably had a considerable incubation period.
Irving Bennett.
Once we figured out that it wasn't the bird flu, but was another sort of flu entirely, I started looking at where it was popping up, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere. Outside of New York, the largest pocket of Super Bowl flu was London. I dug into it more, and as a couple of days went on, I stumbled onto an interesting bit of data, which was outside major population centers, the places that had the highest initial rate of infection for Super Bowl flu were towns with research universities in them. A little more digging, and I discovered that on the third weekend in January, the International Epidemiological Conference held its winter meeting in London, and that the attendees to the winter meeting mapped really well with which university towns had the highest rates of infection. The irony of a meeting of epidemiologists being ground zero for a highly virulent new form of flu was not lost on me, or anyone else for that matter, once the news got out.
Thomas Stevenson, former director, National Security Agency.
When it became clear to us that the IEC winter meeting had been the likely ground zero for what we'd eventually call Hayden syndrome, we naturally began to research, within the confines of the law and always with the highest possible standard of transparency, the attendees of the winter meeting, including their recent research. We wanted to find out who might have been working on research in line with what we were seeing with the new virus. We were naturally concerned that the virus might not have occurred naturally, and that it had been designed as a potential weapon. Was there ever a determination? Neither we nor any other U.S. government agency were able to officially determine the initial source of the Hayden's virus, nor were we able to determine whether the virus was naturally occurring or had been genetically designed. What about unofficially? Quite obviously, I can't comment on any unofficial findings.
Irving Bennett.
I know of two rumors that are given the most credence in the world of Hayden's historians. The first is that after the First Lady came down with the disease that would eventually be named for her, a factory outside of Mirenshaw was air-bombed into rubble. Officially, the factory made cold medicines. I suppose you can guess what the unofficial suspicion was. The Times stringers in the area confirmed the place had been turned to rubble, but neither the Pakistani nor the U.S. government confirmed an airstrike. The official cause for the factory going up was intertribal conflicts. Presumably, one tribal chieftain ordered a truck filled with explosives to drive up to a loading dock and then detonate. There was a Pashtun epidemiologist at the IEC, although he was never charged with anything. A second rumor involves a Swiss biology graduate student who had a bad breakup with his lover, a grad student in epidemiology, and also access to viral material and a gene synthesizer. Whether this dumb bastard intended for his new bug to get out into the general population is up for debate. This is a rumor because there's no hard evidence that the presumed creator of the virus did the deed, and we can't ask him because shortly after the first fatalities associated with the virus started cropping up, he took a rifle and shot the back of his head out with it. His former lover, incidentally, was fine, never even got sick. Both of these rumors are reasonably plausible, but for practical purposes, they both can't be true. So, which of these two rumors you find more compelling is a personality test, in a way.
Natasha Lawrence.
It was clear this wasn't the H5N1 variant, so we started breaking it down to see what we had. What we had was a virus that had a widely variable but long incubation period. That's the time between when you get the virus and when you start showing symptoms. But a short latency period, meaning the time between when you catch the virus and can start spreading it to other people. Long incubation plus short latency means there's a fairly large window for subclinical infection, people infecting each other before they feel sick themselves. So that's what happened here. The Hayden's virus is transmissible by air, which makes it easy to catch. By the time the International Epidemiological Conference winter meeting had adjourned, roughly 80% of the 1,000 or so attendees had been infected. They had been in close contact and breathing in each other's air the entire 3 days. And then, when they dispersed, they traveled back to several hundred points of origin on 6 separate continents, traveling in airplanes packed with other people. From a virus's point of view, you couldn't have asked for a more optimal transmission pattern. Now, that's optimal for the virus. It's not optimal for us. When it came to the Hayden's virus, by the time we knew what we were dealing with, we also knew that it had potentially already spread to millions and possibly billions of people. What we didn't know was how serious this new virus would be. We had half of New York throwing up in ER rooms, but we didn't know how long it would take for the virus to resolve itself and for the body's own systems to beat it. We did know we didn't have a vaccine. The Hayden's virus initially presented like an influenza virus, but when we started looking at it, we realized we really were looking at something new. So the sort of antivirals we use for flu, the neuraminidase and M2 inhibitors, weren't necessarily going to have the same effect on Hayden's. So no matter what, we were in for a rough time.
Monique Davis.
The first phase of Hayden's looked like flu and acted like flu, but it was the worst flu we'd seen. Lots of vomiting, lots of respiratory congestion, fevers as people's immune responses kicked into overdrive trying to kill the virus from the inside. We treated what we could treat, but after Super Bowl Sunday, we knew we were up against something different. People started to die. old people, people with weakened immune systems, then infants, which was heartbreaking. Those were the most vulnerable populations with any influenza infection, however, so no matter how heartbreaking, it was still understandable and to some extent expected. But then, otherwise healthy people started dying as the Hayden's virus just overwhelmed their systems. One kid came into the ER complaining that being sick was messing with his training for the Mohawk Marathon in Albany, which was going to be run a couple of weeks later. He was dead by morning. That was the frustrating thing about Hayden's. Outside the usual at-risk groups for opportunistic viral infections, there wasn't any rhyme or reason to who got sick, who got better, and who didn't. It was like flipping a coin. Heads, you were sick for a day or two, and then you were fine. Tails, you were laid up in the hospital for a week, or you were dead. About a week into it, everyone stopped calling it the Super Bowl flu and started calling it the Great Flu, because it was something that just wasn't stopping. It was like the Spanish flu in the early 20th century, except so much faster and so much more.
Benjamin Maldonado.
The parallel with the flu pandemic of 1918 to 1920 was obvious, but it's also inadequate. The Spanish flu took 2 years to circle the globe because transportation was slow, and the outbreak happened at a time when the global population was under 2 billion. There were more than 7 billion people on the planet when Hayden's hit, in an era when you can get from one side of the planet to the other in less than a day. The spread of Hayden's was exponentially faster, and affected an exponentially larger number of people. We did have better understanding of disease, and a more coordinated global response working for us, but unfortunately, given the specific nature of how the Hayden's virus transmitted, those came into play only after the virus had already spread itself across the planet.
Irving Bennett.
We were having a newsroom meeting about how to deal with the coverage, and my then-editor Brenda Strong said, "It's like a coordinated attack. It's like this virus has blitzkrieged every single place people live." And that's exactly what it was like. We were getting the same news reports that everyone else was seeing, and it was astounding. It was literally everywhere. The only place it seemed not to be was the science stations of Antarctica. New Zealand actually stopped flights down to the South Pole to keep it from getting there. The Hayden's virus went from not even existing to becoming the major global health crisis of the 21st century in under 2 weeks. Nothing like that sort of epidemic spread had ever happened before in the history of the world. It was like viruses declared war on humans and were planning to wipe us out before we could even mount a counteroffensive.
Thomas Stevenson.
Before we learned of the International Epidemiologist Conference's winter meeting, we very seriously considered whether this was in fact an attack on the United States by a hostile party, either a nation-state or a terrorist group. The problem was none of our chatter had indicated that something like this was in the offing. And this is, to be blunt, one of the things we had tuned ourselves to be looking for. It seemed unlikely to us that something of this scale could have been planned without our hearing of it. The enemies of the United States have a tendency to try to pump themselves up before an attempted attack. We didn't pick up any gloating transmissions before Hayden's got onto our radar. Even if Hayden's had been designed to attack the U.S., it was a very poor instrument for the task. We were hard hit by Hayden's first wave, but we and most other Western and industrialized countries immediately coordinated our responses and locked down further immediate spread of the disease. It was the places without the ability to effect a coordinated response where the disease really took a bite, both immediately and with the later stages. This is why, on a personal note, I think biological warfare ultimately never caught on. Attempting to use a biological agent against your enemy while avoiding its effects on you is like trying to use a grenade by holding onto it and hoping all the shrapnel flies in the direction of the person you want to kill. You have to be stupid or suicidal to use biological weapons. Whoever invented Hayden's, if it was invented, was probably both.
Benjamin Maldonado.
2 weeks after Super Bowl Sunday, we had 1 billion people infected worldwide, including 50 million in the United States roughly 1 in 7 people in both cases. By the end of 4 weeks, it was 2 billion and 80 million. By the end of the year, 2.75 billion worldwide, 95 million in the U.S. 1 in 3 people.